over her large glasses with eyes the color of floodwater. She resigned herself to a spot on the floor next to Scott. The woman told Scott she had been there the day before, but they only took 4 people. When social workers began appearing at desks behind the glass, she observed, "They are calling the county to see how many spots are available."
"For what?" Scott asked sardonically.
"For you. You're here to get treatment, right?" Scott looked up at the ceiling's fluorescent lights and inhaled slowly, purposefully. He was trying to endure.
"Yes?"
"Look at that girl." The woman motioned to the white teenager. "She looks suicidal. I'll bet they take her in. You have to camp out to get a spot."
Scott began to tap his foot.
At 8:10 a.m., a woman wearing gold earrings and a silk blouse opened the door and announced that they could take 5 people today. A man emerged with a clipboard.
"Number 1, number 2,
he began counting. The line stood and tightened. Scott stepped toward the elevator and pushed the down button. He could have tried again the next day, but he went on a 3-day bender instead. 15. A nuisance. The day after Crystal and Arlene's argument, Trisha came downstairs from her apartment after Chris had gone to work with Quentin. Trisha liked Crystal. She was much more youthful and silly than Arlene. That morning, the two women passed the time fooling around and playing patty cake. Their palms slapped together as they sang, "Shame, shame, shame. I don't wanna go to Mexico no more, more, more. There's a big fat policeman at my door, door, door. He grabbed me by my collar. He made me pay a dime. I don't wanna go to Mexico no more, more, more." Arlene watched, unamused. She was reviewing apartment listings and making notes on a notepad with "house" written in block letters at the top. She regretted not going to a shelter after eviction court. But she hated shelters. Mostly, she hated the other residents. Collecting her papers, Arlene nodded at Crystal and left to find a new place to live. Arlene was able to call on 2 dozen places before heading back to 13th Street. She had no leads, but was undefeated. "If I keep being persistent, I'll find me a house," she told herself. She also believed that Sharina had dismissed her eviction. She had not. When Arlene came back, the apartment was quiet, and Crystal looked troubled. After Chris had gotten home from work and Trisha went back upstairs, Crystal had heard him yelling at her for smoking his cigarettes and drinking his beer. She had heard other noises, too. "The lady upstairs getting beat," Crystal told Arlene. "Who cares? I don't," Arlene answered. She had painful menstrual cramps and just wanted to lie down.
"I kind of figured that was going to happen when he got here."
Arlene didn't feel she had enough space in her head or her heart to consider Trisha's problems. Her own problems were enough. After night fell, more sounds came through the ceiling. There were blunt and muffled thuds, interspersed with loud pounds when Trisha slammed into the floor. Arlene covered her head with a pillow, but Crystal stewed.
"I ain't fixing to see no woman getting beat up by no man," she said.
She wanted to help Trisha, but she also couldn't help feeling repulsed by her weakness. She pitied Trisha and found her pathetic.
"If a man hits you like that and you let him back in, you like it,"
Crystal mused. At one point, she had had enough. Crystal climbed the steps to the upper unit and yelled through the locked door,
"I'm gonna dot your eyes, you scary hoe, and I want Chris to hear me too, 'cause I dare him to put his hands on me."
Arlene had to pull Crystal back downstairs. Crystal called Sharina, who didn't answer. Then she called 911 3 separate times. The police finally showed up and took Chris away. When they left, Arlene looked at Crystal.
"You must want to lose your house," she said.
The next day, the police called Sharina. The officer, a woman, sounded stern, but Sharina had been through this before. Last year, she had received a letter from the Milwaukee Police Department regarding the same apartment on 13th Street. Pursuant to Section 80-10, Milwaukee Code of Ordinances, MCO, the letter began, "I am informing you that the Milwaukee Police Department has responded to nuisance activity at your property on at least 3 occasions within a 30-day period. It then listed the nuisance activities, which included a fight and a woman being sliced with a razor blade. The letter went on to inform Sharina that she would be subject to a special charge for any future enforcement costs for any of the listed violations that occurred at her property. The city had itemized all police services down to $4 per 911 call. Sharina was to respond in writing with a plan to abate the nuisance activities occurring at her property. Should those activities continue, the letter concluded, she could be subject to a fine between $1,000 and $5,000 or thrown in jail. Sharina wrote back to the Milwaukee PD, explaining that the 911 calls that had generated the letter were attributed to a domestic violence situation. If these problems continue, she wrote, I will ask her to vacate the premises. When the district captain read Sharina's reply, he underlined the word ask and drew a question mark in the margin. Not accepted, he scribbled on her reply. After she was notified that her abatement plan was rejected, Sharina stapled a copy of an eviction notice to her next letter to the police. The district captain wrote back, This notice serves to inform you that your written course of action is accepted. Now 13th Street was a nuisance again, with issues upstairs and down. Most of Crystal's 911 calls were on Trisha's behalf, but once she had also called after getting into a roaring argument with Arlene. The police officer on the phone was asking Sharina to explain why her former and current tenants were living together. Sharina told the officer how Crystal and Arlene had met. When the officer asked Sharina why she had allowed such an arrangement, Sharina replied by saying that she had felt sorry for Arlene. But neither of them have a pot to piss in, she said, and they don't have a window to dash it out of. The officer laughed. She did wrong for trying to sublease my place, Sharina said. You know, Crystal doesn't quite understand that it's her place, but it's not her place. The call had embarrassed Sharina. I'm steady trying to work with these low-quality people, she said after hanging up. She had been content to turn a blind eye to Arlene still being there, but now the police were involved. The officer advised Sharina to toss them both out. Sharina decided to start with Arlene. She called her and began yelling into the phone. I'm sick of the bullshit, Sharina said. Sick of this motherfucking shit. Tired of you throwing your fucking weight around when you're the one who owes. When your kids didn't have nothing to eat, who was it that went to the church and got a big box of food, milk and stuff like that for them? When you first got there, who had spent her money and she didn't ask for it back? And you know. Hello? Hello? The police had called Sharina on a Saturday. She had told Arlene to be out by Monday. Sunday morning found Arlene sweeping the carpet as Trisha looked on. On the kitchen counter, cornbread was still caked in the pan, the brown edges giving way to the spongy yellow middle. The night before, Arlene had made muffins, too, and boiled pinto beans and neck bones. Her brothers had come over to eat, smoke, and throw spades upstairs at Trisha's. They drank, but knew not to offer Arlene a cup. She almost never drank alcohol, didn't like the feeling. Thing I hate about Milwaukee, Arlene said, is that the rent is so high. High, Trisha agreed, clicking her tongue. I pay upstairs $450 for a one-bedroom? The house was quiet, with Crystal and Jory at church. Jory had gone with his dad. Jafaris sat silently on the floor, coloring. Arlene tried to calculate how much time she had. If Sharina served the writ the next day, that's still another 5 days to get my stuff out of here before the sheriff come. Trisha nodded. Arlene sat down at the table and looked at Jafaris while talking to Trisha. We in this house, so I didn't think about moving. I didn't have to think about my kids changing schools. I didn't have to think about none of that. No sense in crying, she said, straightening up. I might as well wipe my tears and do what I gotta do. She called Sharina. Arlene started and stopped, her words caught at the bottom of her throat. But she managed to ask Sharina if she could stay until Thursday. Sharina said no, and Arlene protested. That's Crystal,
Ain't no police been called besides Chris beating up Trisha. It's been her. In the last decades of the 20th century, as the justice system was adopting a set of abrasive policies that would swell police forces and fuel the prison boom, it was also leaving more and more policing responsibilities to citizens without a badge and a gun. What about the pawn shop owner who sold the gun? Isn't he partially responsible for the homicide? Or the absentee landlord who failed to screen his tenants? Didn't he play a role in creating the drug house? The police and courts increasingly answered, yes. It was in this context that the nuisance property ordinance was born, allowing police departments to penalize landlords for the behavior of their tenants. Most properties were designated nuisances because an excessive number of 911 calls were made within a certain time frame. In Milwaukee, the threshold was 3 or more calls within a 30-day period. The ordinances pushed property owners to abate the nuisance or face fines, license revocation, property forfeiture, or even incarceration. Proponents argued that these new laws would save money and conserve valuable resources by enabling police departments to direct manpower to high-priority crimes. In 2008 and 2009, the Milwaukee PD issued a nuisance property citation to residential property owners every 33 hours. The most popular nuisance activity was trouble with subjects. A catch-all designation applied to a wide variety of incidents, including people refusing to leave a residence and loud arguments. Noise complaints came second. The third most common nuisance activity was domestic violence. The number of domestic violence incidents, most of which involved physical abuse or a weapon, exceeded the total number of all other kinds of assaults, disorderly conduct charges, and drug-related crimes combined. One incident involved a woman having bleach thrown in her face. In another, a woman was hit on the head with a can of food. Two involved the battering of pregnant women. Box cutters, knives, and guns were used. In one incident, the caller stated that her boyfriend just sprayed her with lighter fluid and also set a piece of paper on fire. Most nuisance citations were addressed to properties on the north side. In white neighborhoods, only 1 in 41 properties that could have received a nuisance citation actually did receive one. In black neighborhoods, 1 in 16 eligible properties received a citation. A woman reporting domestic violence was far more likely to land her landlord a nuisance citation if she lived in the inner city. In the vast majority of cases, 83%, landlords who received a nuisance citation for domestic violence responded by either evicting the tenants or by threatening to evict them for future police calls. Sometimes, this meant evicting a couple. But most of the time, landlords evicted women abused by men who did not live with them. One landlord wrote to the Milwaukee PD, "This is one girl in one apartment who is having trouble with her boyfriend. She was a good tenant for a long time until her boyfriend came around. Probably things are not going to change, so enclosed, please find a copy of a notice terminating her tenancy served today." Another wrote, "I discussed the report with my tenant. Her boyfriend had threatened her with bodily harm and was the reason for the 911 call. We agreed that he would not be allowed in the building, and she would be responsible for any damage to the building property and evicted if he returned to the property." Another wrote, "First, we are evicting Sheila M., the caller for help from police. She has been beaten by her man, who kicks in doors and goes to jail for 1 or 2 days. Catch and release does not work. We suggested she obtain a gun and kill him in self-defense, but evidently she hasn't. Therefore, we are evicting her." Each of these landlords received the same form letter from the Milwaukee PD. "This notice serves to inform you that your written course of action is accepted." The year the police called Sherina, Wisconsin saw more than one victim per week murdered by a current or former romantic partner or relative. After the numbers were released, Milwaukee's chief of police appeared on the local news and puzzled over the fact that many victims had never contacted the police for help. A nightly news reporter summed up the chief's views. He believes that if police were contacted more often, that victims would have the tools to prevent fatal situations from occurring in the future.
What the chief failed to realize, or failed to reveal, was that his department's own rules presented battered women with a devil's bargain. Keep quiet and face abuse, or call the police and face eviction. Crystal blew through the door, along with the cold air, and the house tightened up. Church had taken a lot out of her, and her stomach was touching her back, as the saying went. She poured herself a bowl of Cap'n Crunch and planted herself on the love seat. She was wearing a black and gold silk blouse, a calf-length skirt, and a red head wrap. Crystal was aware of Arlene's situation, having returned Sharina's call on her bus ride home. Sharina had given some ground. Arlene could stay until Thursday if Crystal agreed to move into one of Sharina's other properties. If Crystal said no, Arlene had to be out the next day. Her cereal gone, Crystal was still hungry. She put some of Arlene's biscuits in the oven. "You want some of these, baby?" she asked Jafaris. "He don't want none of that," Arlene snapped. "You can't get mad at me. You can take it out on Sharina. I'm pissed off at you, and I'm pissed off at Sharina. I have no control over what my landlords say," Crystal interrupted, pleading. "I told y'all can stay until February, because that's what you paid me for. But Sharina said that you gotta go. I have no say-so over that, because I'm not fitting to be out in the street because somebody gave me $150. Crystal breathed in deep and continued. "I'm not fitting to get irritated. I'm not fitting to get agitated. I'm not fitting to get frustrated. I'm not fitting to call Mama and tell her I ain't got no peace, because I got peace right now, and I'm keeping it. I'm keeping it. I'm keeping it. You got peace, and me and my kids got to go." Crystal bit her lip and looked to the ceiling. "I can be out tomorrow. It don't matter. You can put my biscuits back in the refrigerator where you got them from," Arlene was yelling now. Crystal shook her head and called Sharina. "Which day did you say you want Arlene out? Monday? You said Monday?" Arlene began pacing around, talking to the room. "I really, truly hate that I got into this situation. That's bogus. That is bogus as ever. I swear to God, that is bogus. I called the police," Crystal was telling Sharina. "Chris and them was making a lot of noise upstairs, and he was up there beating on that girl." Arlene asked for the phone, and Crystal ignored her. Arlene began to shake. "Now look. Now my kid's homeless, nowhere to go, and ain't got no money. Fuck me and my kids. Just fuck it. Fuck it." Crystal had never seen Arlene like this, so unraveled. She handed her the phone. "I mean," Arlene said to Sharina, "they just throw me and my kids out on the street after I got my money, after we ain't got nothing no more. It was okay that we were here up until last time when the police got called. All I can say is thank you for what you done for me and my kids. Before Thursday, me and my kids will be gone. That's my promise. I can't give you nothing else." Arlene listened for a few seconds before shutting the phone while Sharina was mid-sentence. "I feel that we getting used. Me and my kids getting used." She looked at Crystal, who that morning carried an old and calm spirit. "I'm frustrated," she apologized. "If I took my anger out on you, I'm pissed. Arrangements was made." She slapped her palm with the back of her hand. "But the reason I know what you feel is that my family did this to me. The issues you got, can't nobody fix them but God. I don't have nothing but a trust issue, and I'ma always have a trust issue." Arlene sat down. "But you shouldn't speak that over yourself, 'cause everybody's not out to get you." "Everybody they is, though. You don't know what it's like. You don't know what I've been through. You don't know what it's like to have your father molest you and your mother not care about it." It was her stepfather, the minister. She was 10 when it started, and 16 when it stopped. "Oh, yes, I do," Crystal said. "Yes, I do. I know exactly what that's like, because my stepfather molested me when I was just a little girl, and that's why they sent me to the foster care. I swear to God, I know exactly what you've been through. I swear to God." Arlene took it in. Jory had led Jafaris into their bedroom and turned on some music, which drifted into the living room as the women let a moment of shared comprehension pass in silence. Each knew something of the other's pain. The boys were sitting on a mattress, playing with Little. Arlene dropped her head, saying,
I'm sick of getting hurt. Okay, you know what? Crystal said. I remember this like it was yesterday. I've been going to church for a month or so, and the Spirit moved on me, and I told God, I'm tired of hurting. I'm tired of crying. I'm tired of suffering. I'm tired of people hurting me. But it's just to build and make you, because me being hurt, me being lied on, me being talked about, me being abused, everything, me being in foster care, me not having no mama, me not having no daddy, siblings don't care, aunties don't care, uncles don't care, made me. If you want me to love you, how can I love you if you don't trust me? How can I comfort you? Can't nobody help you unless you allow them to do it. You've been molested? I've been molested, too. At 10, I had a flashback, and I was 5 years old. I looked at my mother, and my mother was still doing drugs. My mother stayed with this man. My mom did the crack pipe. She was pregnant with me. My dad beat my mom, and my mom got stabbed in her back 11 times. So I know God got a calling on my life, but if I don't allow him to use me to do that calling, how can he do it? Church was awesome. I could see the Spirit of God. I can feel the Spirit of God. I know when the Spirit moving in church because it'd be real smoky. And people might think I'm crazy for believing like that, but, I mean, that's how I believe. My pastor treats me more like a daughter than my mother. I can say that much. And once again, I can't say how you feel because you don't have a mother, but once again, I can... Everybody goes through stuff in life, and you're going to continue to go through. Your situation is to make you. It's to build you. I went through it all summer, all summer. Felt like I didn't have nobody, was ready to do crack this summer. But I prayed a prayer that my pastor prayed over me 2 years ago, and I firmly stand on that word and believe in it. I didn't even tell my pastor that my mama did crack at this time, and my pastor walked in the aisles, laid her hands on me, and said, Mama did crack. You ain't gonna do crack. All I could do was cry. Crystal's last word lingered in the air until it dissolved in the chattering of the television. Arlene sat there, stunned. Her phone rang and snapped her back. A friend had a lead on an apartment.
Does he do background checks and stuff?
Come here, Crystal said once Arlene was off the phone. Arlene obeyed, and Crystal held her.
What's the rent at that place?
You know what? I didn't even ask him. Arlene called back. Learned it was $600 a month, and hung up.
Nope.
Crystal left to inspect Sharina's other apartment.
It's gonna be all right, she told Arlene. If I can't promise you nothing else, it'll be all right. That much I can say.
16. Ashes on Snow. When the first of the month came, commas once again returned to Sharina's bank account. It wasn't any ordinary month either. It was February, when tenants received tax credits and wrote big rent checks. One had cashed her tax return and paid Sharina $2,375. Doreen came up with $950, as her stipulation dictated. Lamar paid $550, but since his painting job had earned him nothing, was still behind as far as Sharina was concerned. He would have to be evicted. Maybe to fully efface the recent memory of being broke, or maybe just for the hell of it, Sharina and Quentin took themselves to the casino on a Wednesday night. Sharina put on a rock-aware sweatsuit, maroon and gold. Quentin sported a G-Unit leather jacket, a straight-billed black cap, and a large pinky ring. He found a handicapped parking spot near the main entrance of Pottawatomie Casino and hung from his rearview mirror the necessary permit, a gift from a handicapped tenant. As they made their way to the bar and grill, past the robotic jungle sounds from all the machines, Sharina smiled impishly and said,
I hope you don't have nothing planned for the morning.
She could pass entire nights at the casino, staying until 3 or 4 a.m., long after Quentin had gone home to sleep. After dinner, where they discussed Sharina's upcoming presentation on the art of the double closure over burgers and Long Island iced teas, they headed to the blackjack section. Sharina walked slowly through the tables and decided on the one with two white men, one alone and smoking, the other jittery with a high-fiving blonde on his shoulder.
Sharina placed $100 on the table. The minimum bet was $25. She rarely played for less, and pulled up a stool. She stayed quiet at the table, tapping her finger for a hit and slicing two through the air to pass. Across town, at 18th and Wright, Lamar dealt the cards as Luke, Eddie, Buck, and some of the other neighborhood boys gathered around the table. It was a bitterly cold night, and the warmth of their bodies was fogging up the kitchen windows. The game had a different rhythm, slower and less boisterous, because Kamala was there. Lamar had been asking Kamala to join him at spades ever since she moved upstairs, and she finally said yes, arranging for her father to stay with her daughters as they slept. Kamala had a man, Devin, the father of her children, but Lamar flirted softly with her all the same. The presence of a woman had a way of altering the house's chemistry. Before she was pregnant, Natasha once had caused so much tension at the spades table, solely by being beautiful and desired, that Lamar cut the game short and kicked everyone out. But the boys were on their best behavior around Kamala. They didn't talk much about girls and refrained from calling Lamar a monkey's ass, as they had been doing since he shaved his mustache. Kamala was only a few years older than Natasha, but seemed much more of a woman to them, encased as she was in a hard shell of dignity and world weariness. Lamar's New Year's resolution was to honor God, stay clean, and find a new place. Sharina had been ignoring his requests for repairs. The kitchen sink had been leaking for the better part of a week and was now running onto the floor. Lamar figured Sharina would not let him stay much longer anyway. Maybe it was for the best, he thought. Maybe his next place could also be a safe haven for all his boys. Lamar didn't understand why Sharina treated him like she did. Why would you fuck someone that's not trying to fuck you? He wondered. Sharina wondered the same thing. Lamar said the sink was broken. Sharina said he broke the sink. Quentin didn't join Sharina at the blackjack table. He never did. Instead, he watched from a distance and made sure nobody got angry or fresh with his wife. Whatever pleasure he took from being at the casino had to do with seeing Sharina happy. Quentin hated gambling.
Bam, there goes $50 right there, he murmured
after Sharina lost another hand. Cards fell. The night unfurled. Quentin took a phone call, hung up, and approached the blackjack table. He brought his face next to Sharina's and whispered that 18th and Wright was on fire. She immediately collected her chips and followed Quentin out the door. Doreen's? Sharina asked when she caught up to Quentin.
No, the back unit.
Lamar's?
No, the upstairs. Kamala's.
Quentin sped away from the casino.
Lord, please, please let this be something minor, Sharina prayed, holding onto the door handle as the Suburban careered through the back roads that led to 18th Street.
Lifting her head, she fretted.
Shame on them. I hope my shit ain't burnt to a crisp.
When Quentin tried turning down 18th Street, he met a roadblock.
Already that motherfucker lit up like Christmas down here, he said.
He could see fire trucks in front of the property, their red and white lights shooting out in every direction, but not the house itself. Quentin tried another route, then another, but fire trucks and ambulances had blocked off the surrounding streets and alleyways. As he maneuvered the Suburban, Sharina caught brief glimpses of the scene as it flashed up through breaks in the neighboring houses. Finally, Quentin tried a back alley a block behind 18th Street. Through the Suburban's window, the shadowed rear of a garage gave way to a snow-covered abandoned lot, and the property showed itself in full view. Sharina lost her breath.
Damn, that's real bad, Sheer,
Quentin let out. The house was engulfed. Flames were leaping from the roof and disappearing into a milky column of smoke and steam towering into the winter sky. Quentin and Sharina watched firefighters' silhouettes dash around what had been Kamala's apartment, now a gutted, charcoaled shell. What was not burning was slicked in ice from frozen hose water. Quentin headed toward the house. Sharina stayed put. The fire reminded her of the time a disgruntled mortgage customer tossed a homemade bomb through her office window. Since then, the sight of fire disturbed and reduced her. Quentin recognized Luke as Lamar's eldest son, even as he was crying with his head between his knees. A teenage girl consoled him on Doreen's steps. It was hard to hear over the noise, the grumble of diesel engines, the jackhammer whirring of the water pumps, the sizzle of water meeting heat, the splitting of wood under axes. Patrice was outside, too, shivering in only a t-shirt and jeans. She motioned to Quentin and, lifting her voice, hollered in the direction of a firefighter.
"He the landlord?"
The firefighter nodded and approached Quentin. Bystanders' faces glowed orange out of the darkness when the flames burst upward. Patrice allowed herself one more look at the paramedics gathered at the rear of an ambulance and went inside. The Hingston's house, separated from the back house where Lamar and Kamala lived by only a small patch of mud and weeds, was crammed with people. Doreen was sitting near the front door, cradling her youngest granddaughter, Kayla May. Natasha was on the floor next to Ruby, draped in a blanket. The rest of the Hingston kids sat in a row on a mattress, wide-eyed at the weight of the moment. Lamar was slumped in his wheelchair, rubbing his head and drying his eyes. Eddie and Buck stood by his side. White people in hard hats milled through the crowd, apologizing and collecting information.
"I'm sorry, can I get your name?"
Patrice, who had seen a firefighter carry something to the ambulance under a white sheet, looked at Kamala. She was writhing on the floor, screaming,
"My baby, my baby!"
Her hair had been burnt off on one side. She arched her back and pressed her face into the ground. An older woman nobody recognized tried to hold her.
"Whoa,"
she would say as Kamala lurched.
"Whoa."
When the old woman grew tired, she let go. And Kamala collapsed onto the floor, wailing. Devin walked into the house, carrying two of his daughters, both toddlers. He pushed the scared girls past the crescent of police officers who were surrounding their mother. Kamala sat up and pulled the girls in. She clung to them, kissed their faces all over, and pressing her head into theirs, spilled her tears onto their hair. An older firefighter stepped into the Hingston's house. He knelt down beside Kamala and told her what she already knew. Her youngest daughter, 8 months old, was dead. Kamala fell back and let out a trembling, otherworldly groan.
"He killed my baby,"
Kamala screamed, convulsing.
"I'ma kill him! I'ma kill him!"
Devin began pacing the room with clenched fists. Over and over, he whispered,
"That's the second one. That's the second one."
At one point, he stopped and stood over Kamala. The room hushed and looked on. Devin looked to be on the verge of violence, but the moment passed, and he resumed his pacing and mad chant. "That's the second one." They had lost a baby just a year earlier, a daughter who was stillborn. Kamala and Devin wore her ashes around their necks in matching lockets.
"Oh, God,"
Sharina said when Quentin told her.
"I hope they didn't leave that baby at home by herself."
Sharina's mind drifted back to earlier years when she was a fourth-grade teacher and Kamala her student.
"She was always a good girl in school,"
she said. Back at home, Quentin and Sharina tried putting the pieces together.
"Devin and Kamala," Quentin began, "was downstairs,"
Sharina followed,
"playing cards with Lamar, and maybe left something on. And by the time they realized it was a fire, they tried to run upstairs, but it was too late."
Quentin keyed the computer to see if the fire had made the news. It had. "Firefighters did not hear smoke detectors when they arrived," he read.
"There is a smoke detector in the kitchen," he said.
"There's supposed to be one in each sleeping area,"
Sharina replied.
"I thought we had put some smoke detectors up there. I can't remember right now."
The following day, Sharina heard from the fire inspector. He said the fire had started when one of Kamala's daughters climbed out of bed and knocked over a lamp. Kamala's father had either fled without grabbing the baby or, more likely, left the girls alone earlier in the evening. Both Kamala and Luke had tried to rescue the child, but the fire was all-consuming. Kamala's other two daughters walked out themselves before the fire got out of control. Nobody had heard a smoke detector go off. The fire inspector told Sharina she didn't have anything to worry about. She wasn't liable for anything that had happened.
Sharina then asked if she was obligated to return Kamala's and Lamar's rent, since the fire happened a few days after the first of the month. The fire inspector said no, and that settled it in Sharina's mind. "They are not getting any money back from me," she said. Sharina figured both Kamala and Lamar would ask for their rent to be returned, and she was right. Sharina planned to tear the place down and pocket the insurance payout. "The only positive thing I can say is happening out of all of this is that I may get a huge chunk of money," she said. That, and getting rid of Lamar. The Red Cross would find Lamar and his sons a new place to live, giving Sharina one less eviction to worry about. Earlier that morning, loud knocking had pulled Doreen out of bed. She opened the front door in her nightgown to find reporters with cameras and microphones. After a few questions, Doreen shut the door and told herself not to answer it for the rest of the day. She walked through the kitchen and looked out a back window. Kamala's second-floor apartment looked like a dark cave. The windows had been broken out and a large section of the roof was gone, leaving only support beams. Runoff had left the siding streaked with gray grime. The snowy ground was blackened with ash. Scattered about were roof shingles, long pieces of wood, the skeletons of furniture and other household items. A gnarled junk heap all charred and coated with hardened foam from the fire hoses. Water had frozen into thousands of icy bulbs that appeared to drip off the tips of surrounding tree branches. Doreen lowered her eyes and saw, on the house's front porch, 6 white lilies tied with a cream ribbon. Spring, in the dead of winter. Part 3. After. 17. This is America. Arlene was in the living room at 13th Street, shivering. She didn't have a winter coat, so she pulled on another t-shirt and an oversized hoodie. The Milwaukee weathermen had been working themselves up. They said it was going to be the coldest week in a decade, that the temperature could bottom out at 40 below with the wind chill. The local news kept flashing a warning. Frostbite time, 10 minutes. People were urged to stay inside. Arlene had 3 days to find another apartment. Sharina was done with both Arlene and Crystal. The conversation with the Milwaukee PD had spooked her. She decided to have the sheriffs remove Arlene and deliver Crystal an eviction notice. "I'm not going to be arrested because of those people over there," Sharina said. "I'm not going to have them take my property because of them. I'm tired of this shit. Arlene is being real selfish. She doesn't care about anybody else but her and her kids. She doesn't care about me." Sharina faxed a copy of Crystal's eviction notice to the Milwaukee PD. A few days later, she received a letter back. "Your written course of action is accepted." Arlene had made an appointment with the landlord and was waiting outside her apartment complex when the woman pulled up in a Subaru, 30 minutes late. Tall and white, in a North Face fleece and new tennis shoes, she rushed to an apology and introduced herself as Carol. Carol's apartment was a small and plain one-bedroom unit, renting at $525 on the northern edge of the north side. It took Arlene all of 30 seconds to scan the place and say that she'd take it. She didn't like the apartment or the neighborhood or the fact that the boys would have to switch schools again if they moved there, but all that was secondary. "It don't matter," she thought. "A house is a house for now." Carol decided to screen Arlene on the spot. She sat down on the floor in the empty living room and asked Arlene to spell her name and provide her date of birth and social security number. Carol's first substantive question was, "Have you been evicted in the last 3 years? I'm going to check CCAP, so you might as well get it out in the open." Arlene had given Carol her real name and wasn't sure which evictions were attached to it. So she decided to tell Carol what she had been through since being forced to move from the condemned house with no water. She told her about the drug dealers on Atkinson and her sister dying. This took a while. There were so many moves and so many details, and soon Carol's confusion turned to annoyance. She cut Arlene off and asked about her income. "How long have you been on W-2, and what's the reason?" "They actually had me on W-2T because I go to counseling for depression. I go see my therapist once a week, and they have me doing a job search. They're trying to get me job ready, but they're also trying to get me to apply for SSI. Better to not live on either, Carol said, telling Arlene to get a job.
I know, Arlene said.
Arlene fudged her income, telling Carol she actually received child support. And after Carol said, we don't have any kids in this building, Arlene lied about her kids, too, mentioning only Jafaris.
I need to come see where you live now,
Carol told Arlene. She said she'd stop by 13th Street in a couple of hours. Back in her apartment, Arlene took out the trash and swept the carpet and hid all of Jory's clothes. There was little she could do about the bathroom. There was standing water in the clogged tub, and the sink didn't work. But the light was also out, so maybe Carol wouldn't notice. In the kitchen, Arlene stood over the sink, staring at a pile of dishes. Little rubbed himself against her legs and meowed for food. They were out of dish soap, so Crystal's laundry detergent would have to do. As the water ran, Arlene placed both hands on either side of the sink. She scrubbed the pots. Her phone rang.
It's nothing,
she said to the person on the other line.
Nothing. Nothing.
Then she allowed herself a hard cry. Crystal, who had stayed on the couch and watched Arlene frantically scurry around, got up and embraced Arlene. Arlene cried into Crystal's shoulder, and Crystal did not pull away. When Arlene stepped back, Crystal said, I promise you, if you believe, you will have a house. The apartment looked decent when Carol showed up. Arlene had even sprayed Febreze. After a brisk walkthrough, Carol sat down at the glass dining table.
This just, honestly, does not look good, she began. And yeah, I understand your sister died and everything, but how is that your landlord's problem?
I understand what you're saying. Arlene thought that white people liked it when she said, I understand what you're saying, and I'm trying to get my stuff together and stop making dumb choices, and I'm going to start going back to school for my GED. And eye contact. Lots of eye contact.
I'm not saying it isn't terrible, Carol continued. But I mean, we actually have an employee whose mother died, and she had no insurance or anything. The county paid. You know, they give you $300 or whatever for the funeral, and that's the funeral she got.
Eye contact.
So what changes are you going to make so that I'm not throwing you out in a month?
Carol tapped her pen. At this point, Arlene had applied for or called on 25 apartments, and Carol was her only hope. Sensing that hope pulling away, Arlene played the only card left in her hand. She offered Carol the option of arranging a vendor payment with W-2, which would automatically deduct rent from each month's check.
So that by the time I get my check, you already have your payment.
I like that, Carol responded, surprising herself.
That sounds like a good compromise.
Then she added, the cat can't come.
Okay.
I was going to say, you got to worry about feeding Hugh and your kid.
I want to give you a hug because...
Let me just... Arlene hugged Carol, who blushed and dashed out the door. Arlene hugged Crystal and ran around and danced.
I got a house. I can't believe it. I got a house.
Carol told Arlene that she could move in the first of the month. Until then, Arlene planned to take her boys to a shelter and lock her things in storage. As a shelter resident, she would be eligible for Red Cross funds that would cover her security deposit. It was the only way she could give Carol all her money. Arlene collected cardboard boxes from neighborhood liquor stores and began packing her things.
Don't cry when I leave,
Arlene told Crystal as she placed dishes in a box.
Bitch, you act like you're gonna be gone forever. You're gonna come around, 'cause you can't live without me now.
And you can't live without me either, Arlene smiled. Crystal began clapping her hands and singing,
I ain't going, I ain't going.
Then she slapped Arlene on the back.
Ow, Crystal,
Arlene said, and the two women wrestled a bit, laughing. As Arlene resumed packing, Crystal asked,
Could you leave me some dishes?
Arlene set a few aside. At sunrise on Thursday, the sky was the color of flat beer. By mid-morning, it was the color of a robin's egg. The still and leafless tree branches looked like cracks in the sky's shell.
Cars rolled slowly through the streets, caked with salt and winter's grime. Milwaukee public schools canceled classes because of the cold advisory. Arlene's boys weren't going anyway. She needed them to help her move. Jory loaded a U-Haul truck that a family friend had rented for them. The cold gripped him. His fingers and ears began to sting. Icy air filled his mouth, and it felt like his gums were hardening into one of those plastic molds of teeth in the school nurse's office. His breath was a thick white gauze circling his face. He smiled through it, happy to be useful. After a few trips, Jory ate his pride and put on Crystal's sand-colored coat. Crystal herself sat on the floor, covered in church-donated blankets, eating banana pudding and watching talk shows. The night before the move, Arlene had glued on a new wig and cleaned her shoes. She wanted to look younger than she was because who knew whom she might meet at the shelter or public storage. No shelters had called back, and Arlene didn't know where she and her boys would sleep that night. She would have to worry about that later. For now, she was focused on taking what she could to a storage unit. The man behind the counter at public storage wore a pinky ring. His hair was slicked back, and he smelled of liquor and cheap aftershave. Arlene's storage unit would be C-33, a 10-by-10-footer. "It's the same size as the truck you got," the man said with a Texas drawl. "All you got to do is be creative." Everything fit easily. Arlene had scraped together $21 for the discounted fee by selling some food stamps and a space heater. Next month's fee would be $41. But she didn't realize she had to buy a lock and $8 worth of insurance, too. She didn't have it. The Texan, whose weather-worn face told her that he had seen hard times, too, found Arlene a lock and let her slide on the insurance. She thanked him before shuffling through the cold concrete lot to close the orange aluminum door to C-33. At least her stuff had a home. They spent the night, then the weekend, back at 13th Street with Crystal, sleeping on the floor. Arlene called the lodge and other shelters, but they were full as usual. On Monday morning, she tried domestic violence shelters and secured a room at one she had stayed at years ago, when fleeing Jafaris's father. When Arlene called Carol to tell her the name of the shelter for Red Cross money purposes, she learned that Carol had rented the apartment to someone else. Arlene didn't ask why, but she figured Carol had found a better tenant, someone with more income or no kids. Arlene let out a long, emptied-out sigh and balled herself up in a chair. "I'm back to square one," she said. Soured, Arlene gathered their last remaining things in the apartment. She took down her curtains and remembered some dirty clothes that were in Crystal's closet. She and Jafaris brought Little upstairs to Tricia. "Take care of kitten," Jafaris asked. "I am, baby, I promise," Tricia answered. He thought and said, "Give him some food." Arlene planned on leaving behind her love seat, which had collapsed since Crystal began sleeping on it. Besides that, in a scattering of clothes, blankets, and broken lamps, the place was barren. Then Arlene remembered that she had bought a $5 adapter that connected the stove to the gas line. She told Jory to remove the part, which would have rendered the stove useless. Seeing this, Crystal screamed, "Get out of my house!" She began picking up Arlene's things and throwing them out the front door. "I don't need none of your shit. Got me fucked up. Stankin' ass bitch," Arlene yelled, getting in Crystal's face. "You call me stankin', but whose clothes you got on? Mine's. My shirt. 3 days in a row, you nasty bitch. I'll hit you in your mouth," Jory yelled at Crystal, running up. He put his nose inches away from Crystal's face and cocked his fist back. "I'm finna scrap you," he yelled. "I don't give a fuck about no fucking police." Suddenly, Quentin was in the room. He had been showing prospective tenants the rear apartment when he overheard the commotion. Quentin walked in the open door and grabbed Jory by the shirt collar. "Hey, hey," he barked. Jory lunged at Crystal. "Come on," he yelled, his fists flailing. Quentin tugged him back. Crystal only stepped closer.
"Look, boy,"
she said, chuckling.
"You are not hard as you think."
"No, no,"
Jafaris cried. Trying to be helpful, he had found a broken shower rod and was hitting Crystal with it.
Arlene grabbed Jafaris and pulled him out the door. At Quentin's prodding, Jory moved in that direction, stopping to kick in Crystal's floor model television. As the family left, Crystal stepped onto the front porch and continued throwing their things everywhere. The front lawn was soon littered with random stuff, school books, a Precious Moments doll, a bottle of cologne.
"Y'all ain't untouchable,"
Crystal was screaming.
"This is America! This is America!"
If Arlene hadn't been under so much pressure, she might have realized that removing the adapter was throwing Crystal's desperation in her face. Maybe she would have been able to defuse the situation. Under better circumstances, they could have been friends. They got on when there was food in their bellies and some certainty about the next day. But Arlene was in the press of the city, depleted. So when Crystal exploded, Arlene exploded right alongside her. Crystal could quickly turn violent. The year before she met Arlene, Crystal had been examined by a clinical psychologist who diagnosed her with bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, reactive attachment disorder, borderline intellectual functioning, neglect of a child, sexual abuse of a child as victim, and emerging personality disorder dynamics with borderline features. Her childhood had left a mark. Crystal is highly sensitive to anticipated rejection, abandonment, and harm in her relationships, the psychologist wrote in his report. She has immense underlying rage at significant others for their perceived unwillingness and or inability to respond to her needs for nurturance, security, and esteem. She has limited ability to tolerate much in the way of frustration or anxiety, and a proneness to act out her tensions without much forethought or deliberation. She is still seen as being fragilely integrated. The report surmised that Crystal had an IQ of about 70 and anticipated that she would need long-term mental health treatment and supportive assistance if she was to be maintained in the community as an adult. And yet there she stood, alone, in an empty apartment. Crystal picked through the things Arlene had left behind. When she wandered into the kitchen, she discovered that Jory hadn't been able to remove the stove piece, but he did cut the electrical cord. Crystal told herself she wasn't planning on eating that day anyhow. Pastor had called a fast. 18. Lobster on food stamps. The line around the welfare building spanned the length of Fleet Street and wrapped around the corner. Barricades had been erected and extra police officers summoned. The governor had announced that food vouchers would be given to households affected by storms that had flooded parts of the state, including Milwaukee County, and by 7 a.m., thousands of people had lined up, jostling for position, and even trying to get inside by taking a door off its hinges. The Marsha P. Coggs Human Services Center was massive. Three stories of cream brick, it had 170,000 square feet and 232 large windows. The building had originally held a Schuster's department store. But the store, along with the surrounding neighborhood and city, had fallen on hard times around mid-century. It was finally shuttered in 1961, and the building sold to the county. When the building was renovated in the early 2000s, it consolidated 450 county employees under one roof. A California-based artist was commissioned to install bright, multicolored ceramic tiles above the windows that displayed words like contemplation and dance. She called her installation Community Key. A little past 8 a.m., Lorraine walked past the crowd and made her way inside, hardly looking up to notice the strolling security guards or escalators transporting people between floors to fill out forms and meet with caseworkers. She took a number, 4023, and waited. Lorraine was there to get her food stamps reinstated. Soon, not a seat was empty, and room 102 filled with the sounds of children and chatter. An older woman leaned on her umbrella and tried to sleep. A mother spanked a toddler. Another was engrossed in women who love too much. After 1 hour and 40 minutes, Lorraine's number was called. Not bad, she thought, having spent entire days in the welfare building. I had an appointment on the 20th of this month, Lorraine explained to the multitasking and manicured woman behind the glass. But I got... Between the time of my scheduled phone call, I had gotten evicted. You have to reschedule your appointment, the woman replied. It was another missed meeting and another canceled benefit, both the result of an eviction that threw everything off course. The woman handed Lorraine some papers. Here is a list of things you need to bring with you. I don't have anything with me, Lorraine replied, reading the list. Most of the necessary paperwork was in storage.
Well, if you don't have anything, then you can't bring anything.
The woman smiled. Lorraine looked confused.
But will I still get my benefits?
That's why you have to come in for the appointment. I can give you a food pantry referral. Would you like to go to the food pantry? Lorraine took an escalator downstairs to the food pantry, walking out with two grocery bags filled with canned beef and kidney beans and other things she hated. Sometimes family members who didn't know any better would ask Lorraine why she didn't just call to schedule her appointments. Lorraine would laugh and ask, "Oh, you want to try the number?" She had never once gotten anything but a busy signal. At her follow-up appointment, Lorraine managed to get her $80 a month food stamp allowance reinstated, even without all the necessary paperwork. Leaving the welfare building, she shuffled past throngs of bored, tired people and street alcoholics congregating outside and into a nearby furniture store with bars over the windows. Inside, experimental jazz was playing over an organized clutter of plump recliners, dark wood dining room sets, and brass lamps. A salesman with a Middle Eastern accent approached Lorraine, who asked to see the armoires. She inspected a 7-piece bedroom set. She gawked at a 62-inch television.
"I have TVs smaller than this," the salesman said.
"No, but I want this one." Lorraine smiled.
"Why don't you do it layaway, then?"
"You have layaway?"
"I love layaway."
Lorraine was participating in a kind of cleansing ritual, swapping the welfare building's miasma of unwashed bodies and dirt with the smell of a new leather sofa. She was also entertaining a fantasy of making a good home for herself and her daughters. Jamie was finally out of prison and staying with Lorraine and Beaker until she found an apartment. And maybe Megan would come around. She used to put the girls' clothes, new clothes, on layaway. To Lorraine, putting something on layaway was saving.
"I can't leave money in my bank," she said. "When you're on SSI, you can only have so much money in the bank, and it's got to be less than $1,000, because if it's more, they cut your payments until that money is spent."
Lorraine was talking about SSI's resource limit. She was allowed to have up to $2,000 in the bank, not $1,000 like she thought, but anything more than that could result in her losing benefits. Lorraine saw this rule as a clear disincentive to save.
"If I can't keep my money in the bank, then I might as well buy something worthwhile. Because I know once I pay on it, it's mine, and no one can take it from me, just like my jewelry."
Well, no one except Eagle Moving. Before her eviction, Beaker had asked Lorraine why she didn't just sell her jewelry and pay Tobin.
"Of course I'm not going to do that," she said.
"I worked way too hard for me to sell my jewelry. I'm not going to sell my life savings because I'm homeless or I got evicted." It wasn't like she had just stumbled into a pit and would soon climb out. Lorraine imagined she would be poor and rent-strapped forever. And if that was to be her lot in life, she might as well have a little jewelry to show for it. She wanted a new television, not some worn and boxy thing inherited from Lane and Susan. She wanted a bed no one else had slept in. She loved perfume and could tell you what a woman was wearing after passing her on the sidewalk.
"Even people like myself," Lorraine said, "we deserve, too, something brand new."
Lorraine didn't put anything on layaway that day, but when her food stamps kicked in, she went to the grocery store and bought 2 lobster tails, shrimp, king crab legs, salad, and lemon meringue pie. Bringing it all back to Beaker's trailer, she added Cajun seasoning to the crab legs and cooked the lobster tails in lemon butter at 350 degrees. She ate everything alone, in a single sitting, washing it down with Pepsi. The meal consumed her entire monthly allocation of food stamps. It was her and Glenn's anniversary, and she wanted to do something special.
"I know our relationship may not have been good, but it was our relationship," she said.
"Some things I will not ever get over." But the lobster helped. When Lorraine spent money or food stamps on non-essentials, It baffled and frustrated people around her, including her niece, Sammy, Susan and Lane's daughter. My Aunt Lorraine is one of those people who will see some $200 beauty cream that removes her wrinkles and will go and buy it instead of paying the rent, said Sammy, a hairstylist with her own shop in Cudahy. I don't know why she